Welcome to the C21 podcast. My name's Jonathan Webdale. In today's episode...
After living for nearly 100 years on this planet, I now understand the most important place on Earth is not on land.
More than 30 flood warnings have been issued across the UK after days of unprecedented rain.
Every officer's to have another officer in their field of vision at all times.
Check for anyone who needs help.
Will do.
The ocean is our planet's life support system and our greatest ally against climate catastrophe. Yet it's but a crossroads.
With Earth Day having taken place this week, a new landmark documentary Ocean with David Attenborough due out next month, we investigate how the TV industry is performing in terms of its commitment to addressing climate change. We'll be hearing how, despite UK broadcasters making a very public pledge almost 4 years ago to champion the issue, it's nigh on impossible to get any of them to talk about it right now. And even a cross-party industry body set up specifically to tackle it now seems reluctant to speak. And we'll also hear the views of two people working hard to advise and support those looking to tell environmental stories, whether through documentary, entertainment or scripted dramas, such as ITV's After the Flood, which you also heard at the top of the programme. Lucy Stone is founder of consultancy Climate Spring and Steve Smith, co-founder of Picture Zero. We'll be hearing from them later on. But first, I spoke with C21's Louise Bateman about our own Big Picture initiative and the in-depth piece she's just written exploring how the TV industry is currently performing on driving positive action for our planet. Okay, so Louise, you're curator of C21's Big Picture initiative. Just remind listeners what that's all about, if you would, please.
Yes, of course. C21's Big Picture, it's an ongoing initiative, and it's there to support positive change in and through the content business. It's a mixture of things. We do features, interviews, we do some news as well, but we also have an advisory board and it feeds into our events as well. So, for example, we have Big Picture sessions at Content London. And it's got four key areas of focus: inclusivity and diversity, sustainability and environment, business practices and operations, and content and storytelling.
Okay, so as you say, one of the initiative's key objectives is shining a spotlight on what the TV industry is doing in terms of promoting sustainability and environmental issues. And you've written a piece for our C21 Investigate strand recently, available on our website now, all about the present state of play there. I mean, the UK, you know, we've got schemes like Albert, which sits within BAFTA. Back in 2021, I think it was, at COP26, the likes of the BBC, Sky, ITV, Channel 4, they signed the organisation's Climate Content Pledge. What impact have those initiatives had, and you know, how is TV faring on tackling climate change in programming and its own performance?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. And actually, the 4 months that I spent researching my article was trying to dig deeper into that that pledge, which, of course, you know, is pretty groundbreaking. I would say that around a dozen broadcasters network signed the pledge in the UK, and it was, I'm told, a big moment when it happened. However, 3 years down the line, just over, and nobody seems to be in any great rush to talk about it. The strange thing is that there is evidence of programming having been commissioned in this space. You can find a published update on the Albert website, which provides some details about the progress against the pledge by the likes of the BBC, UK TV, ITV, 5, Channel 4, Sky, RTE. Even specific programmes are mentioned: the BBC's natural history series Asia, ITV's Loose Women's Earth Day, and Channel 4, you may recall, it did a climate change season at the end of 2023. That was just some of them. The heads of those organisations, all of them are pretty much quoted. But the problem is getting hold of anyone from those organisations to question them directly. That has been the challenge, which I think is quite concerning in the main, because these are public service broadcasters in the main. So I think they need to be held accountable, and, you know, not just by publishing what they want to tell you, to actually speak to journalists about what they're up to.
I mean, it's almost 20 years now since the release of former US Vice President Al Gore's documentary feature, An Inconvenient Truth. The current US administration obviously has a slightly different view of things, and perhaps we'll talk about that a little bit later. But as you mentioned there, and as you said in your article, finding execs willing to discuss progress, particularly at a commissioning level, felt like pulling teeth. Indeed, no one from Albert even would respond, I believe, to your request for interviews. So is it that the issue is simply too political at the moment?
Politics undoubtedly has something to do with it. I mean, only this week we found out that the BBC presenter Evan Davis was required to give up hosting a heat pump podcast that he's been hosting for a while, and that was due reportedly because the BBC is worried about being accused of political bias. So it does feel very tricky politically, and that's a great shame. But I think also feels like this is an issue, in spite of its enormous importance and urgency, where the PRs at these organisations don't seem very well briefed on the matter, and where below the very top level execs at these organisations, no one seems to be given the authority or responsibility to talk about it. That's what it feels like from where I'm sitting and through doing this article. Heads of sustainability, for example, they can talk about sustainability performance, but not content strategy or committing decision making, which is understandable, but then these are content organisations. Their whole business model is based on that. And then we've got commissioners who can talk about strategy, but they were really hard to pin down. So it really felt at times as though I was being given the runaround. I do know that commissioners are receiving climate training. So I do think perhaps there's some anxiety around talking it. You know, rightly or wrongly, people, unless, you know, there's this fear because the scientists have been sort of in that space for many years, that those that are outside feel that they don't know enough about it. But actually, it is very much about communication these days, climate change. And I think the other big issue is the state of the industry itself. So since 2021, when the UK Climate Content Pledge was made at COP26, peak TV has crash landed and commissioners are more risk averse. So I would think that that's playing into it as well.
So a couple of people that you did speak to for the piece, however, were Lucy Stone, founder of an organisation called Climate Spring, and Steve Smith, co-founder of a firm called Picture Zero. So we're going to be hearing from them in a moment, but just tell us a little bit about each of those and what they had to say.
Yeah, that's right. It was a really different story when approaching these individuals and organisations, which, of course, they're not the gatekeepers, but they are playing a vital role in helping to drive change within the industry. They were very happy to talk. So Lucy at Climate Spring is really interesting. This is not an NGO, but a community interest company. And as well as acting as consultants, so it consulted on ITV's After the Flood series, for example, series one, it has also got a development fund, which means it can help producers and creatives who are keen to make projects in this space to get them into development. It operates globally as well, which is quite unusual, and it works across documentaries, film and TV, and currently has more than 40 projects on its slate. Now, some of those they're consulting on, but some of those they're developing. Steve Smith comes at this from a slightly different angle. He actually sits on the Big Picture Advisory Board, and he's very knowledgeable in this space. His company, Picture Zero, is UK-focused, and it started out with the aim of producing climate-focused TV programmes, but it found out pretty quickly how challenging it is to convince commissioners of the value of such programming. It has since pivoted towards consulting and training. Steve's really positive about the progress the industry is making. But, you know, he has had a negative experience himself. He produced a show called The People Versus Climate Change, and that follows members of the UK's first ever Citizens Assembly on climate change. I've seen it, the show, and I can tell you it's not only really informative, but it's compelling telly as well. But they couldn't get the show commissioned, and so they ended up making it and funding it themselves. They finally convinced the BBC to pick it up, and guess when that aired? So it was November the 16th, 2021. So in the run-up to COP26. As a public service broadcaster, you'd think this would be a core programming for the BBC. But in fact, it was too risk-averse to commission it. So that's the kind of the environment that producers who want to make programs in this space are operating in or have been.
We mentioned An Inconvenient Truth earlier on, and in movies, Don't Look Up, I believe, is Netflix's third most watched film of all time still. There's also a new Steve Coogan movie, The Good Life, coming up, which Climate Spring is also involved in. But what about TV shows tackling environmental issues? David Attenborough's Oceans is coming out next month. Natural History has been focusing on this topic for many years now. But beyond that, what is happening in unscripted and scripted? You mentioned After the Flood on ITV, there's been Toxic Town on Netflix, but it seems slim pickings beyond Natural History, as I say.
Yes, the data certainly doesn't show the industry in a great light. And my article does go into this in more detail. We have some data from Parrot Analytics. It really is quite shocking, actually. But on the top of the poor figures, what I found surprising is a kind of downgrade, even a denial of climate change when it's this key storytelling hook or device. So that's especially in the scripted space. So you mentioned about After the Flood. But for example, Families Like Ours, there's a TV drama series set in Denmark, and I talk about that, or I write about that in the feature. And it's set in the near future when rising sea levels have caused the country to be evacuated. Now, it's true that its Oscar-winning director, Thomas Vinterberg, wanted to avoid disaster film cliches and to focus on the human drama of climate change and mass migration. But what struck me was how everything from press releases to exec speaking on the subject pointedly avoided referencing the climate event. They really didn't want that to be part of the marketing of the programme. The same was true of After the Flood, which is a crime thriller, but as the title suggests, takes place in the aftermath of a flood. That series one, I believe series two, I think there may be a wildfire. The commissioner did not want to talk about it in the context of climate change, or rather he downplayed. He said that that wasn't the story. Now, obviously, drama is about people, but these are storytelling devices, and it's interesting, really. What worries me about that approach is that it seems to deny what audiences are concerned about, and they really do care about climate change. All the data points to this. For example, a rather large piece of global research just carried out for the Nature Climate Change Journal found that 89% of people around the world want more climate action, but mistakenly they assume their peers do not. Now, that's really critical, I think, if you're working in the content industry and you have a platform and you have that responsibility to communicate. Because if people are concerned about it, but they don't think other people are, there really is a problem there. And so does the content industry have an important responsibility to close the gap? That's the question.
So I'm just wondering, I suppose, you know, in examples like those, you know, where climate change or environmental issues are sort of within the show, but they're not part of the marketing. I mean, you know, is that because commissioners, broadcasters, actually they just want to make these issues part of the everyday kind of narrative that's going on, not necessarily foregrounding it so much, but just making it part of everybody's daily lives? I mean, isn't that really the case? And you know, I'm thinking also in the unscripted space, it's interesting hearing from the interviewees that we've got coming up how efforts are being made within cooking shows, for example, to replace gas stoves, gas ovens with induction hobs, for example. Just sort of weaving the issues more into the fabric of programming, but not necessarily putting it in the headline, I suppose. Is that necessarily such a bad thing?
No, not at all. And actually, the normalization, I think, is what hopefully everyone is aiming for. But given the data is suggesting that the industry is doing pretty badly, given the time that's elapsed since An Inconvenient Truth, almost 20 years, so there is a sense of urgency around this. And really, it's about calling a spade, I think. That's the point, I think, which is worrying. Why can you not have a conversation about it and your reasons for doing it? I mean, Anna Jane Joyner, who runs Good Energy, this NGO in the US, who's done lots of work in this area, you know, she hates this term, and I may misquote her slightly, of hiding the broccoli in the brownies. I mean, audiences are not stupid. And I, as a journalist, I'm not stupid. So really, why can we not have a conversation about if there is a climate change device? Why is that a problem to talk about it? on the positive side, there's a lot that is happening. The BBC, for example, has made it mandatory for all producers it works with to speak to their commissioners about how their shows address sustainability and the environment. They're tracking that. They just started that at the beginning of the year. You know, and other broadcasts, Channel 4, Sky, ITV, also doing this, I understand. That's what I've been told. But what I think is worrying is the lack of conversation and what appears to be the lack of accountability in terms of talking to journalists about it.
There's plenty more to explore in your C21 Investigates piece, which is titled Why Climate Change on Screen is Still an Inconvenient Truth. So listeners, do please go and read all about that. But in summing up, Louise, I mean, you've also written this article to tie in with the C21 Big Picture Climate Consensus. So tell us what that's all about and how listeners can get involved.
Yeah. So as part of its commitment to support positive change in and through the content business, C21 has launched the Big Picture Climate Consensus. It's a global initiative to determine the entertainment industry's response to the climate emergency. And really key to this is building consensus around the best ideas the entertainment business has as a community to address the climate crisis. So the project is powered by POLIS, that's spelled POL.IS. It's an open source AI platform, and the machine learning takes a temperature check of what a community is thinking and drives informed decision making around that. It's already used by governments, businesses, NGOs. We are inviting executives within the industry, wherever they work, whatever level they work at, to join in the conversation. We're calling it a conversation because we're trying to build consensus. What is really important to be aware of, it's completely anonymous. And, you know, the idea is that we get the best ideas that the majority of the people agree on. So there's voting, but you can also provide your own statements. They're curated, they're checked, and then they're uploaded. It opened about a month ago, but we're running it. And the idea is we will get a report that will come out of it, and then we will present that at Content London 2025.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Louise. So listeners, yeah, please do check out Louise's piece, C21 Investigates Why Climate Change on Screen is Still an Inconvenient Truth. And also go to the C21 Big Picture Climate Consensus and share your views there. Those will be reflected in that report, which Louise highlighted will be coming out at Content London towards the end of the year. Thanks very much for that, Louise. And now we'll hear from some of those people that you interviewed for your article. Lucy Stone, founder of Climate Spring, and Steve Smith, co-founder of Picture Zero.
There's been a sort of growing little ecosystem of organisations that have kind of grown up to try and serve this need. This need is that the TV and the film industry or the entertainment industry has kind of recognized this is, you know, the biggest story of our time, and they're not really telling it. And there's an appetite to do that, but it's not easy. It's not easy. It's challenging how you do that. So there's a growing number of organizations. Most of the organizations, I'd say, that have kind of developed in response to this are they're either NGOs, kind of environmental NGOs, trying to advise the industry on their climate messaging. So they advise, they will run workshops and do consultancy and, you know, provide, advice and guidance on how to do this. But it's from an NGO perspective of what the environment movement needs rather than necessarily from an industry perspective. And then there's the kind of industry convening organizations who are trying to kind of corral and convene the organization in the way BAFTA Albert are doing around the Climate Content Pledge and the Sustainable Entertainment Alliance in the US. Where we differ is, so we're essentially an industry fund. We're a company working within the industry with a development fund with a very kind of simple mandate that by providing some development funding and then a lot of support in identifying IP, in packaging up projects, being an intermediary between the creatives and the producers and the commissioners who are all interested in this space, we provide development funding in the form of investments. So very soft term investments. We get our money back on first day of production if the project project goes into production. So obviously there's a risk element to development funding. And we do that merely for two reasons. One, because then we're engaged on terms, on industry terms as EPs. You know, we exec produce the project, we're invested in the project. We can editorially consult and advise as it's being developed and bring all the climate expertise and support. But also we bring a lot of industry consultancy support. So my team are all hired from development commissioner backgrounds. So they will also bring that editorial development support. And then the second reason is because we're trying to create an evergreen fund and keep recycling the fund into more projects. So that's our core model, development funding. But that comes with this support, which is, you know, there is a huge interest, as you know, as I said, there's a huge interest in telling these stories from talent, from creatives, from producers, also from commissioners. It's not easy how to do this within, especially in the current climate in the entertainment industry. It's not straightforward. It's got to be entertaining first, got to be commercially driven projects. It's not even easy, even from a climate perspective, right? How to cut through the jargon and the noise and, you know, the complexity to tell a very sort of straightforward, interesting, compelling story. So that support, and I can tell you a bit more about what that support looks like, is almost as important as the funding, you know, and it's small amounts of funding. We're not a major funder, but that sort of seed funding, as you know, can be very critical in the industry when you don't often, you know, when development funding is scarce and particularly at the moment being cut back. That development funding can mean an idea just moves forward far faster than it would if it was going through the usual process. But also it means that project, that idea is being developed within that, in a kind of commercial context with that support. So that's our model. We're funded by philanthropic foundations. And we are also setting up a production fund, which will be separate from our development fund. And this is backed by social investors. So it will make a return that it's, you know, being invested in by investors who like the environment. Environmental return as much as the financial return. So we're in this quite neutral space. So we talk to commissioners a lot to try and identify, you know, what their gaps are, what they're looking for, and what's working, what isn't working. And then producers and creatives who are, you know, trying to feed that market. And that is also involves quite a lot of sourcing material and intellectual property. So we've supported the Climate Fiction Book Prize as an attempt to try and stimulate IP for the market. And that is, as it says, you know, that's a literary prize with the Hay Festival, find the best climate fiction book in English language published in the UK. And that has also helped kind of stimulate the literary world. You know, similarly.
Is this kind of because of the risk averse nature of TV at the moment?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. It's a bit, you know, just commercially the realities of where the industry is, and IP hugely helps, but also it de-risks it a bit, doesn't it? You know, it's been tested in the market in a way, and it's content that's already been developed, so it kind of speeds that process up. But the other reason is, so one of the key things that we found ourselves doing a lot of work on is, if you know, as you no doubt know, if you go to a commissioner or even a creative or a producer and you say we're interested in climate storytelling, you know, people will define that and interpret that in a very narrow way. So it's the same thing with the climate fiction world. You know, cli-fi was quite a kind of dystopian kind of one note genre, very good and becoming quite a powerful genre, but it was becoming quite a narrow kind of definition of what climate fiction was. And so what we've tried to do is really just broaden that out. So a lot of our work is really opening minds to see that climate fiction doesn't just have to be dystopian and bleak, but neither does it just have to be about communicating the problem or explaining the science. You know, climate fiction could be grappling with the root cause of the problems. So it could be a book about colonization, or, you know, it could be the book about the origins of the fossil fuel industry, or a good old-fashioned justice story of, you know, accountability. And also, so can it be a kind of world-building story that's looking to the future in which we've maybe moved away from fossil fuels, or a future that is more regenerative. And, you know, again, that doesn't have to even talk about climate. It doesn't have to mention the word climate. It doesn't have to foreground climate is the problem. But we define that at Climate Spring as part of climate storytelling, because, well, partly because we think that's the power of storytelling, is it can show us kind of where we're going as much as why we are where we are, but also because it's fictional worlds that, you know, you can play with imagining how things might be. And that's the big challenge of where we are, is that it's really hard to imagine the world that is not either going to hell in a handcart, or that is the current world, you know, run off fuels and a very unsustainable world. world. So that's a big part of what we do at Climate Spring, is really trying to expand that definition and get people excited about it. Again, not because it's something morally the right thing to do, and you have to identify as a climate person and want to do this as a kind of a campaign issue, but really because it's also where the market is going, it's where audiences are going, it's where interest is. That's the question, but that's, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, if the content industry is about reflecting on screen what's happening in the world around us, then this is the world, isn't it? I mean, on that point, it's interesting that, you know, war seems to be very much and, you know, the sort of defending from war seems to be, you know, very much dominating the airwaves at the moment. And one could argue that that's not at all helpful for climate action or climate solutions, but could, on the other hand, sort of push that. Yeah, because again, I mean, we know even dramas, you know, have been made about, you know, so many dramas have been made about war. And I mean, Ukraine, which is in one, you know, a lot of their content has. So there's a kind of almost, you know, here we are with, yes, this, you know, this huge threat, biggest crisis. And we're potentially going to be drawn towards these stories, which happen to be fairly dystopian themselves, really, don't they? But somehow we're more used to telling those stories, one might even argue. There's more.
I don't know.
Have you sort of discussed that at all?
We have actually. There's also been a real nostalgia trend, right? There's been a real trend for nostalgia, looking back, period dramas, 90s nostalgia and TV. And I mean, I argue that that's because looking to the future at the moment is quite scary, right? People, and there's lots of evidence to show this, people are really, understandably, really terrified about the future, not just because of climate. They're scared about AI, they're scared about war, they're scared, you know, there's so many layers of things to be scared about. But that hasn't always been the case, right? We can think of periods in TV and film history where looking to the future was kind of exciting. It was a place to play and explore and imagine, you know, flying cars and, you know, all the things that will happen in the future, and that kind of sci-fi kind of excitement about the future. I think we've lost that because it's become a bit of a scary place to look at and we don't want to look at it. But the flip side of that is, if we keep doing that, it's a kind of feedback loop, comes self-serving. And we know that young audiences now are looking for, I mean, aside from looking for climate content, which is a bit of a narrow way of thinking about it, they're looking for, if not kind of, you know, utopia, kind of everything's going to be fine. People are looking for feel-good escapism. I mean, you always have. But that's been a big shift. You know, people are enjoying romantic comedies in a way, and ensemble dramas are supposed to single hero, are going to be saved by single hero stories. And I think some of these market shifts show this kind of zeitgeist shift where people are looking for something different, but they're just not quite yet being served. And that's the kind of lag, I think, that we're seeing, isn't it?
Well, just out of interest, after the flood, did you help fund the development of that?
No, we didn't actually. No, that had already been greenlit, but it was a really great example of the commissioner and the producer, Sam, at E Street, and the screenwriter. All of them were really interested to make this a good climate story. And of course, they all wanted to do that so that it was, you know, not marketed as a climate story, because no one would watch it, but be marketed as a police procedural and, you know, good murder mystery, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, they're calling it a thriller, and they talk about thriller. The first series is, you know, after the floods, and then this next one is another threat of wildfires. Nowhere in the press release is there any mention of climate.
But this is kind of deliberate.
Yes. Well, I put that question to them because it's quite interesting from that whole point of view. Why is it deliberate? Yeah. Because they don't want to.
I think it's the right call, because I think, so we were, it's already been greenlit, but the production company and the screenwriter and the commissioner asked us to help them because they wanted to do it well. You know, well, this is an opportunity to get some really good climate messages into a show that was going to happen where there was appetite to do that, albeit without it killing the entertainment of the story, right? But that's, we're down with that. That's our goal at Climate Spring. But they really didn't want this to be marketed as a climate story because they didn't think anyone would watch it if they commissioned it, or it would skew the watching audience. And, you know, this is a big play for them. They put a lot in this. They wanted it to be a success, and they thought if they market it as a climate story, you know, you just, it would not.
So they're worried about, because it's politicized, isn't it?
I think if you market something as a climate story, you are already putting some people off. And what I mean by that is, like, even I worked on climate all life. Yeah. And do I, at the end of the day, want to sit down and watch a climate drama? Actually, not always, you know. I want to watch something that's meant to be something quite different. So they deliberately wanted to not market it in that way so that people would watch it because it's a great piece of entertainment. And then they'd like the fact that they'd come to the climate story in a different way. And what actually happened, as you said, what was really interesting. So we also didn't really do a big job of promoting our involvement in it. So we did a consultancy on it. We gave them a lot of support in helping them. We suggested some plot lines. We connected them up with some very specific experts around flooding impacts and what happens in flooding. And, you know, we really helped them a lot on the project, but we didn't make a big noise about it too, because we wanted it to do well and see how it was. Climate element. And as you say, what was really interesting is in the reviews, it was reviewed as a great climate story, which was great, but it did, because it gave appetite to commissioners. Then they gave them confidence that, okay, this is good. We weren't called out for trying to be too woke by putting climate into a, you know, something that is a big thrill. Actually, we were complimented on it, and we did it well. And that bit of it, more or less, was good. And so this second season, they're leaning more into the climate story because of that, because that feedback, and because ultimately it did really well. I mean, it was the second most watched ITV show after the post office drama.
Wow.
It was hugely successful, millions of viewers, and they've sold it into all sorts of other territories now and other languages. So they're really happy with it. Commercially, it was successful. And this is key, right? Because if we want more commissioners to commission more content, they've got to see this as a commercial success, as a thriller, not just as their one kind of climate pledge, tick the box, and I commissioned a climate story, but it's applied to the business. It's got to be kind of core to the business.
Top of your film development projects, The Good Life, that's British actor Steve Coogan, so clearly he wants to do something in this area. But also that sounds great. I mean, the London PR guru greenwashes the reputation of the world's worst polluters in terms of a storyline. I would imagine that will capture a lot of audience interest. And of course, Steve Coogan, a great talent to have. So there you've gone for a film. Is there a reason why? Is it sometimes easier to get the films? What's the...
So we've got a whole, our slate is, we have about actually 50 projects now we're supporting. So not all with financing, some is just consultancies, and the majority are TV, but we do have a film slate. So we have a small unscripted slate, which is kind of home renovation shows, cooking shows, that kind of thing.
I'd be interested in talking to you about that side of things, because actually outside of nature and some of the documentaries that are sort of looking at climate disaster events, I would say factual, it's quite sparse and certainly entertainment. Why is that as well? Because obviously some of these programs like The Traitors can attract huge audiences.
Well, basically this is why I set up Climate Spread, is because there was just this huge gap on unscripted. So documentaries I thought were fairly well served, and it's a different strat. I mean, you know, never enough, is there? But, you know, there's the Doc Society have a climate story fund. There's, you know, a good amount of climate documentaries coming out, and it's a different strategy and it serves a different audience. Unscripted space, similarly, I felt was completely a sort of untapped territory. And same with drama. It felt like drama, there's very few drama shows, which is why I set up Climate Springs. On the unscripted side, so I hired David, who's from the unscripted world. And actually, so he's found huge interest because, you know, there's been a lot of conversations within some of the big producers producing all of this content, all of this unscripted formats, reality TV shows, who've been asking themselves this question, what's our big climate format? You know, and the commissioners have been saying, come on, come up with something. And they find it really difficult because there's this gap in knowledge and information, right? If you're really brilliant at coming out with this new TV show format and you go to the usual places of doing your research on what you might focus on, it's really hard to know where to go to get the inspiration and the ideas on climate. And there's so much kind of jargon and it all feels quite boring, I think, honestly. So there's quite a lot happening there. It's all early stage development. But there, I'd say there's definitely massive appetite. We've actually got much bigger slate of projects on the TV side. Some are moving slowly, some are moving fast, and, you know, everything in between. Most are in development with production companies, and some are in negotiation with commissioners. or buyers for. Mm-hmm. And it's a real range from romantic comedies to thrillers to kind of true crime, courtroom drama stories. I'd say we kind of group it into three different categories. We've got a lot on the justice side. In a way, it's the kind of easiest approach, which is who's responsible and what does accountability look like. Big Town, the Netflix show, although it's not about climate, it is about the transition and it is about industrial culpability and responsibility as you transition away from one industry to another and, you know, the cleanup and impacts. Who's responsible for that?
Yeah.
It's a great story. I think they did a really good job. So we have a kind of justice set, and that's a lot of our projects, I'd say, are in a justice category. Then we have a what we call a transition category, which stories that talk about the transition that we're going through in society. So again, that's not necessarily on the nose climate, but it's talking about the change that's happening. And we've got quite a few projects in that criteria, but less. A big focus this year is on growing the number of projects that we kind of describe as world building. What we mean by that is kind of showing visions of the future that we're fighting for. And it doesn't have to be far in the future, sci-fi kind of crazy future scenario. It could be near future, bits of the future now. And we've got a few projects in that criteria, but less, because that is the harder one to do.
Yeah.
A big focus for this year is to grow those number of projects.
And do you work with Europe? I mean, at co-productions, is that something you're doing? And is everything you do on in English language?
Our focus is English language globally. But having said that, we have a partner who's funded us to work across Europe. So we're doing quite a lot of work in France at the moment. We do a little bit in Spain on some Spanish productions. And then there's a kind of growing little movement across Europe of organizations interested in this space. And, you know, in a way, it says something, the fact that there's such a growing demand. I mean, of course, on one hand, it'd say if you have development funding, everyone's always going to want development funding, especially at the moment. But I mean, we just noticed a gear shift of interest, just even in the last year, of talent. The level of production company and writers and interest has just definitely shifted up a gear. And we're totally inundated. And we could fund so many projects across Europe in different languages.
And, you know, obviously we've discussed the drawbacks of a climate content pledge. But are you aware of any other nation or territories where there is this outward level of commitment to do it? You know, I believe it's about 80% of all commissioning that's represented in that pledge in the UK. I mean, is there anything comparable anywhere else?
I know there's been a conversation in the States about having something equivalent, and that there are some efforts to try and make that happen. But I'd say, you know, I almost think because the conversation's moved on so since then, I think then 5 years ago now, isn't it? Is it
when? 2021, I think November
2021. 4 years ago, yeah. Then it was really a way of just starting a conversation that it's not just about your greening your production process, it's about what's on screen and the importance of that. And I'd say that the value of the pledge is almost just getting that kind of commission and high level engagement into what this is and why it's important. I think it's hard to do that now, because I think how do you do that at the moment in the commercial environment? So in a way, like, the challenge now is just to do the work of getting the projects and finding the projects and getting them moving. I think that's the space we're in now. We've got enough commissioners who are proactively looking to buy and commission in this space, and enough writers and producers. It's that finding those projects and helping them develop in a way that can move. You know, we're still hearing from commissioners that they're still not being pitched enough, and they're asking producers, we want to be pitched climate stories, and they're not. And it's because of this nervousness on the producer's side and the creator side, suddenly thinking, well, if I pitch that as a climate story, they're probably not going to like it.
So you sound pretty positive about how things are. I mean, you know, there's this gap, and certainly looking in, it feels like we should be somewhere further forward by now.
I feel optimistic that there is enough ideas and talent and producers and creatives and commissioners who want to do this. The challenge is current context and moving, and, you know, the speed in which a project goes from development to production, especially at the moment, and the kind of, you know, the constrained market that we're in can mean it feels like it's not moving fast enough. But we are also working on a few strategies around existing productions and what we can bring into existing productions, returning dramas, you know, we talked about unscripted, which is much quicker, you know, we're working on other ways that we can help move things along. And we did a course last year. So we did a climate narrative professional development course for script consultants and development execs, so they could think about applying this into their work. The response to that was amazing. So there are now a whole kind of a cohort of of experts who've gone out back into their work to try and apply this. So I feel like the momentum is building. But yes, the nature of this work is also can be slow and can be a bit intangible. So yes, it can feel like it's not moving along fast enough.
And when you think about what, looking at this as an industry, a global industry, you know, in this time where it's so hard to get consensus on things, but what would you think would be the single thing that might help progress this transition to content on screen that's reflecting what's happening out there in terms of the climate?
I do think we just need to turbocharge the pipeline of good stories coming through. That's, I know that sounds obvious, but there's a risk if there's lots of talk and pressure on buyers and commissioners and producers to do this, that you keep going in circles. It's really the how I'm making that happen and showing it. So aside from the obvious, you know, which is more development funding for more projects, I think the other thing is just really exciting IP that might come from not from obvious places. So podcasts, journalists, real stories, real things happening, because we know actually anyone who works on climate knows there's just an extraordinary number of amazing people and organizations doing incredible work on trying to decarbonize society from very small scale, kind of community scale, to really big, ambitious kind of tech solutions, and find ways to usefully kind of source those and translate those into ways that can get commissioners and creatives excited about developing them, I'd say is a gap.
Lucy Stone from Climate Spring, speaking with Louise Bateman. Now, here's Steve Smith from Picture Zero.
I come from a directing background. That's what I've done throughout my entire career. I've mainly worked in comedy, entertainment, and unscripted stuff. So, for example, I directed the Graham Norton Show for 20 years. So in that kind of multi-camera area. But I've been concerned about climate change for a long time. And when Albert first started in the UK, I contacted Albert. This was, I think, back in 2011, and asked how I could support what they did. And one of the things that I did is I became an Albert trainer. So I became carbon literate as a person, did that kind of course and got those qualifications, and then started training the industry around sort of both sustainable production and editorial storytelling. And then as that progressed, I found myself often going to Albert events and speaking at them. And I guess around sort of 2018, 2019, I was getting a bit frustrated that we were talking a lot about climate content on screen, but I wasn't seeing a lot of things really changing. You know, there were some small things happening. Albert were talking about it a lot. We were bringing the industry together, and there was a sort of, must have been around 2018, 2019, a big Albert event that Christiana Figueres came along to that was all about on screen. And I was interviewed on stage by Solitaire Townsend from Futura. And I got the impression that some of the broadcasters were sort of still seeing it through the lens of nature. So there were lots of talk about, you know, the fabulous David Attenborough type programs, which are really important. I mean, don't get me wrong, we are in a biodiversity crisis as well. And so nature is critical and how we tell that story, really important. But I saw less evidence that we were talking around how we as consumers, individuals, households have to start changing our lifestyle. That I think was sort of lacking a bit. And so at that event, I was contacted by someone who was in the audience there called Fergus Haycock, who came from a sort of finance background, sort of production finance background. And Fergus and I discussed the idea about setting up an indie. So we set up Picture Zero primarily as a climate storytelling indie back in 2019. And very quickly, we secured the rights to tell the story about the Citizens Assembly that the UK Parliament commissioned. So we got the rights to sort of exclusively tell that story. And we thought, God, this is a great story. We actually thought this is so right up the BBC's street, because it was a story about consensus. You know, remember we were, you know, Brexity and all these arguments we were having. So this was about bringing the kind of people of the country together, bringing a diverse selection of people across all ages, representing the whole of the UK, you know, effectively bringing BBC license fee payers into a room to try and get them to find the solutions to climate change. change. So we pitched the idea. The BBC was sort of interested initially. They asked us at our expense if we would sort of do a bit of a taster tape. And so we went to the Citizens Assembly. We filmed the first session and we put a sizzle reel together and showed it to them. And disappointingly, they came back and said, we don't think it's for us. We don't think it's going to have the impact or rate. Unfortunately, by this stage, we were completely hooked. We saw it as a really important project. And because we'd been there for the first weekend of the Climate Assembly, we decided we wanted to carry on with the project. So we self-funded it. We did that with the support of the Doc Society. So the Doc Society have their Climate Story Lab. And in fact, relevant for you, they've just opened it again for funding applications. So the Doc Society, which is supported by the BFI, you know, do have funding to help you tell these really important climate stories. So basically, long story short, we secured the funding from the Doc Society to make this documentary. It took about a year to make because the Citizens Assembly was a whole process, which then kind of went into COVID, which was fascinating as well. So we filmed it. Fergus and I made no money out of this, by the way. It was a passion project for us. We were able to pay the crew and make sure everybody else got paid, but we didn't get paid. And then we produced the documentary, we edited it. And then when it was complete, we showed it to the BBC again. And they said, oh, actually, we do quite like that. We would be interested in broadcasting it just after COP finished, which was the Glasgow one. And so the BBC acquired it for a tiny, tiny fee, because that's what you pay for an acquisition. It had cost us about £200,000 to make. And I just think that's really ironic that the BBC had turned it down as a commissioned project where they would have funded it and actually acquired it. Now, to be fair to the BBC, because, you know, the BBC are doing great work in this place, and I wouldn't want to give the impression that they're not. To be fair to the BBC, it didn't rate. I mean, it had a terrible slot, but where the film has had impact is the longevity of it being on the iPlayer. And actually a lot of the kind of campaigning we did around it, the sort of impact campaigning where the film reached communities and things. And also, you know, it wasn't just the BBC who turned it down. It was, you know, Channel 4, ITV, Sky, Channel 4. You know, we offered it to everyone. Nobody was interested in it. But I think if it had been a commissioned series, you would have had the full support of the kind of the BBC's press machine behind it. Whereas when it's an acquisition, it's kind of treated a bit as a disposable program because they don't pay very much for it. So I think if I'm being honest, the BBC probably saw it as an opportunity of showing that they had something ready off the back of COP that kind of addressed all these issues. I mean, where the film has also had power is it's been shown around the world. So actually, it's been shown to inspire other governments. It's been seen by politicians. It's been seen by NGOs, by lots of other groups. And actually, just to say, it's the fifth anniversary this year of the Citizens Assembly first meeting. And so we're hoping at some point this year to do a bit of a reunion.
That's really very interesting because that's not so long ago, is it? 2019 and then 2021 was when COP26 happened. So we're really talking a matter of a few years ago.
What I think it really shows, and this is what I want to emphasize, is that to be entirely fair to the BBC, they're in a really competitive place now with ratings and with programs. They need content that they know is going to draw an audience because they're competing now with all the streamers and social media and YouTube and all of these things. And what's very clear to me is that most single subject climate documentaries do not attract big ratings. Now, I don't think that means we shouldn't be making them because we've got important stories to tell and we should be making them. And the BBC will no doubt commission these things still, I'm sure. But what I think broadcasters are really keen to do in the UK is to find ways that we can integrate climate storytelling into everyday content. So how do we get climate stories into Casualty, into EastEnders, into The One Show, into the programmes that audiences love and come to? Because that, I think, is where we have the biggest opportunity to influence behaviour change.
And, you know, you coming from the factual entertainment world, you mentioned the Graham Norton show. I know there was a big thing made about Love Island and there was the...
eBay.
eBay. I mean, I know also they had a contestant who is very, very big in sustainable fashion. I mean, he's all over social media, but it doesn't feel very consistent.
I agree that there is more that we can do, a lot more that we can do. And I guess if you were to look at it through the eyes of Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil, they would say we need to be sort of shouting and screaming about this on every single show that we make. One of the things that I would say I have seen a huge shift in is the increased news coverage around climate that all our broadcasters do. I mean, that I think is exceptional. I think it's true that that broadcasters should have been doing this earlier, and it wasn't that long ago that the BBC got into real trouble for having a so-called impartial debate about climate change on the Today programme, and there was a sort of, I think, an Ofcom reprimand about that, but that no longer happens, and if it does happen, actually, well, it shouldn't be happening, it would be against the BBC's current editorial guidelines, and the same for other broadcasters. You know, there's been a huge amount of work that's been done behind the scenes around training editorial staff. I mean, just coming out of COVID, I was helping the BBC do editorial climate storytelling training, and that was done for all the public service editorial facing senior teams, and the BBC continued to do that. So there's been a huge investment in the BBC training their staff around climate change, which I think is really important. A lot of work in sport, and I know that all the other broadcasters are doing sort of similar work as well. I don't want to just make it about the BBC. Yeah. And I think actually, I know for a fact, because I sit in on the meetings, I know for a fact now that all commissioning editors, and I've had commissioning editors come to my training sessions that we've been doing editorially. I know that commissioning editors now routinely ask Indies to think about the Climate Content Pledge and how you can do these things. And I would say that perhaps some of it is quite subtle. You know, one of the things that we talk a lot about is how you can just normalize these actions on screen. You know, how you can show stuff. You don't necessarily need to be talking about it, but how you just normalize it and show it on screen. And I mean, one of the things that we do at Picture Zero in our consultancy role with Indies is that we will regularly do script passes. So we'll look at scripts, particularly for contemporary projects, and just advise about whether there are opportunities to sort of do things in the script that doesn't necessarily change the narrative of the series, but just again highlights the opportunities to normalize sustainable actions. Because I think what we need to do is move society away from a place where being green is considered to be the weird thing to do, you know, that you're a bit of a sort of an eco hippie, and that actually kind of being sustainable is just considered to be an everyday thing that we all do.
I mean, there's also a huge amount of skepticism, you know, and rightly so in some cases, you know, around waste and what happens to our recycling, you know, is it what why bother, you know, it's not being recycled, you know, so there's a lot of that kind of stuff. Obviously there's a lot more conspiracy theories flying around, you know, that case of Valencia where they were saying that it was, you know, there was all sorts of stuff on social media about being geoengineered weather that caused the flood, nothing to do with climate change. You know, there's so much going on, and obviously now, you know, the politics of it, because it is political, obviously the Trump administration coming in, so there's a lot of things that can really make it much harder in a way.
Except I would say in the UK, the positive thing from a climate storytelling perspective is that the Labour government have got a very different approach towards climate change. You know, they've lifted the ban on onshore wind. They've got the commitment to be kind of, you know, a green energy grid by 2030. You know, there's a lot of government policy changes. In fact, there's a new advertising campaign around heat pumps that the government are funding that's coming out. And again, going back to your point about waste, I can't remember who it was, but a sort of climate expert was saying if they could go back and think again about how we start messaging, one of the things they would have done is not put so much emphasis about recycling and waste, because whilst it's a responsible thing to do and it's important that we do it, in the UK, I think waste is responsible for less than 3% of our carbon footprint. And actually, the thing that we need to be focusing more on is how we travel, how we eat, and how we use our homes, because that has the really biggest impact. And so when it comes to storytelling, I'd like to see a little bit less kind of recycling and a bit more about how you use your home, how you travel and how you eat.
But I guess on a global scale, the waste issue is a massive problem. And it affects countries, but so he's a kind of, the bigger picture is a terrible, terrible story. And a lot of, you know, I mean, the fashion industry, huge amounts. But that's obviously, so these issues are so big, but, and you know, they have been tackled, as you say, but in documentaries and so on. I'm interested, well, I'd love to hear from you what's impressed you that you've seen on screen, whether you've had a hand in it or not. And obviously do tell me those projects where you may have had, if you're able to. I don't know what your but I would love your take on the entertainment side of things. You know, that seems to me a way to reach audiences in a way, as you mentioned, nature Yorkshire documentary, they've been doing it. Kids programming a bit. Some dramas are after the flood. There are some, but I would say in the actual entertainment, I would say it's quite hard to think of anything significant.
It's not just about mainstream broadcast media. It's also about the kinds of, you know, screens generally. So, for example, Jon Stewart in the US, you know, is always doing climate content in his kind of show. I mean, there was a brilliant clip that hopefully has gone viral recently, taking down Mel Gibson. So Mel Gibson was on one of these right-wing podcasts, kind of ridiculing the kind of climate scientists about sea level rise. You know, he had this kind of drink with an ice cube in and going, see, you know, when the ice cube melts, you know, it doesn't overflow your glass. And Jon Stewart then completely explained, you know, to someone like Mel Gibson, how when the ice is in the water already, yes, it doesn't. But when the ice on the land melts and goes into the water, how it then overflows, you know. So, you know, Jon Stewart doing great stuff. I mean, there's been a whole series on YouTube, which is comedians talking, translating climate scientists, you know, so Nish Kumar and Joe Brand, you know, they've done some great things. So it isn't always in mainstream.
Well, on that point of YouTube, and we know the eyeballs are going that way, and we also know that the younger generation do care about climate change. Are you doing anything in that space?
So after the People versus Climate Change, we then did about a year of unpaid climate storytelling development. We, you know, we pitch lots of things, including a fantastic green wedding competition format, for example. And we just, you know, we got commissioning editors talking to us. Lots of people said they were interested, but we couldn't get things over the line. And we just felt that from a company perspective, it simply wasn't sustainable financially to sort of be trying to tell these stories and not get them commissioned. So Picture Zero has pivoted into a consultancy now. So the work we do is supporting other productions tell these stories. So one of the projects that we're currently doing is something called Greener Homes. So this is a project that we're doing with Nesta, who are a charity. And basically, this is how do we tell the story of our future homes on screen? So our homes are going to change dramatically over the next decade as we, you know, address climate change. We bring in things like heat pumps, induction cooking, you know, EV charging points, you know, insulating our homes. What will the new homes of the future look like? So this project has been funded by Nesta. We've got a Greener Homes handbook online, which is basically designed to help producers tell those stories. And what we've been doing over the last year is doing Greener Homes briefings. So we have been having sessions with development teams, producers, a range of different indies. We've generally been focusing on factual program makers, but we also have done drama as well, because I think if you're doing a soap, for example, you know, how you show homes on screens in soap and contemporary drama are also important. And it's having a real impact, you know. So for example, at the beginning of this year, one of the companies that we briefed last year, the company that make Phil and Kirsta's Love It or List It, you know, there was a program on Channel 4 beginning of the year, an episode which featured this couple putting heat pumps into their homes. So suddenly, you know, the things that we're talking about in our briefings are now starting to filter through on screen. You know, Channel 5 just recently did a brilliant sort of 1 hour about heat pumps. I think it was called Heat Pumps, Are They Worth It? So this is starting to filter through, and we've had a really good response from producers that have attended these. You know, we've worked very closely with Channel 4. So Channel 4 have got all their daytime key suppliers to sort of come to these briefings, which have been good. We did one last week for the team at Monkey Kingdom that make Made in Chelsea. So there is a real interest. Now, there's obviously a bit of a kind of time lag between people coming and hearing about these things. And a lot of producers are learning about these things for the first time, and then it filtering out into content. So that's one piece of work we've been doing. Another piece of work we're doing is around cookery shows. So what's really interesting is one of the reasons that new house builders still put gas boilers into homes is because they have a belief that most people like cooking on gas. And therefore, if we know we've got to move away from gas in the homes through to other, you know, heat pumps and other forms of electrical heating, how do we kind of shift that a bit? And one of the things that we think is there's a huge opportunity for cookery shows to not feature gas cooking. You don't have to talk about it. You don't have to say anything. You just cook on induction rather than on gas, and you just show it as being normal. And what's fascinating, and I don't think many people realize this, is that most professional chefs chefs now cook on induction in their kitchens, in their kitchens, because it's more controllable, it's cleaner, it's cooler. I mean, if you think about how hot it gets in a professional kitchen cooking on gas, how horrible it is to clean up after service because all the kind of fat goes around the gas burners, whereas on an induction hob, it's much easier to clean down. So generally speaking, professional chefs prefer cooking on induction. Most of our competition shows, you know, things like Bake Off and MasterChef have switched to induction already, but there are still quite a few chefs, generally the sort of celebrity kind of cook shows where the chefs still on screen cook on gas. So I think as part of the climate content pledge, it would be a brilliant thing for broadcasters to try and just say, hey guys, can we just move to induction? That's been a fascinating bit of work. And how do we address with the climate issue, the cost of living concerns as well? Because often some of the things that we can do to make our homes greener can also help you save money. And again, I don't think that our industry always understands some of the sort of good positive community stories that we can tell around this, you know, things like community kind of heat networks and stuff.
Well, it's interesting you should raise the thing about the community, because obviously now we're having climate events, as in weather events, you know, so flooding, you had the fires globally, obviously the LA fires, but the community side of an event like that, just talking about stories and what are those stories that we're more invested in, more community stories. Can you observe that our industry is picking up on those and seeing that there's a story to tell and compelling story to tell?
I think there is. I mean, one of the things I would say is our local regional news programs are telling these stories consistently and a lot more. I think as part of that sort of news climate coverage is increasing, I think those local news programs are really kind of picking up on things that impact their local communities. They know their audiences really well. And of course, it's different depending on where you are, whether it's a sort of a rural community or a farming community or a kind of an urban community. You know, if you're telling stories in London, then there may well be concerns around the impact of flooding over the transport network, you know, tube stations flooding and stuff like that. Whereas if you're a farming regional rural community, it may well be things about, you know, food security and how farmers are being impacted. I see those stories are being told. Perhaps they're not being told as frequently as we might think we need them, but I am seeing those being told across the board.
Are they being dramatized?
They are. I mean, I can't say because of NDAs, but I can tell you that at the moment at Picture Zero, we have just supported a major BBC production that will be telling a kind of climate story next year. I mean, it takes a year in post-production to kind of get these things finished, but I know there's that. And right now we're working on another major drama story that is a climate story that is going to be told, but that won't be coming out until, again, a year's time. There are these stories happening. And these are two big drama stories. They're big drama productions.
You mentioned the BBC, both those cases. I mean, what about other broadcasters?
You've mentioned ITV with After the Flood. I believe there's a second series of that, isn't there, that's come out. I know that Channel 4 have done a lot of work, particularly, you know, they did that fantastic series, a documentary with Joe Lycett about Shell, which was good. And I know, you know, Channel 4 commissioning teams are looking at how they tell those climate stories. You know, it's part of their priorities. And as I was saying, you know, we've worked very closely with the Channel 4 factual and daytime teams over kind of greener homes, you know, how we can bring that storytelling into homes. So all of the broadcasters now have got sustainability leads. And I know those sustainability leads are talking at commissioning level all the time.
Okay, so to wrap up, what's your impression about progress on telling stories about climate? Also, there's one thing that you think needs to be done that could really make a difference. What would it be?
For me, the thing that I think is really important about is showing solutions. We know we're in a climate crisis. You know, increasingly, you know, as you were saying, the public are aware about this because it's now got to that point where it's impacting them. Flooding is impacting people, you know, food shortages because of climate are impacting people. So people are aware of that. And I think what people need is that sense of what are the solutions? How can we show things in a sort of positive light rather than constantly be focusing on the sort of the apocalyptic? I think that is where we engage people. The other thing I just want to also flag is that, I don't know whether you're aware, but Don't Look Up is still Netflix's second most watched movie of all time. All I'm saying is when you get it right, yep, it works. And, you know, that that is testament. I believe it's had something like 171 million views on Netflix. So I think that's really, really interesting. And so climate is happening. It's impacting everything we do. There is a climate angle to everything we do. And I think for producers, just recognizing that if you're not addressing this in your content in some way, just normalizing stuff on screen, then your content actually could look quite dated very quickly. And I think if you want to make sure your content survives, addressing it is critical.
Steve Smith from Picture Zero speaking with Louise Bateman. That's all for this episode, but don't forget to check out Louise's C21 Investigates piece on our website, Why Climate Change on Screen is Still an Inconvenient Truth, and give your responses to our Big Picture Climate Consensus. We'll be back with another episode next Thursday, but in the meantime, stay up to date with all the latest news and views from across the international TV industry by following C21 online, on social media and mobile. My name's Jonathan Webdale. Thanks for listening.